The sutta tonight is number 35, the Chula Satchaka Sutta, the shorter discourse to Satchaka. Satchaka was a troublemaker, and he liked to argue with people, and you'll get to hear all about that, until he came across the Buddha. He got to learn some lessons, but he didn't listen very well because he kept coming back and trying to catch the Buddha in mistakes and that sort of thing. Thus have I heard on one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Visali in the great wood with the hall with the peaked roof. Now on that occasion, Satchaka, the Nigantha's son, was staying at Visali. He was a debater, a clever speaker, regarded by many as a saint. And he was making this statement before the Visali assembly: I see no recluse or Brahmin, the head of an order, the head of a group, the teacher of a group, even one claiming to be accomplished and fully awakened, who would not shake, shiver, and tremble and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in debate with me. A little bit cocky. Even if I were to engage in a senseless post in debate, it would shake, shiver, and tremble if it were to engage in debate with me. So what shall I say of a human being? Then when it was morning, the venerable Asaji, dressed and making his bowl, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Visali for alms. As Satchaka, the Nigantha's son, was walking and wandering for exercise in Visali, he saw the venerable Asaji coming in the distance and went up to him, exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, Satchaka, the Nigantha's son, stood at one side and said to him, Master Asaji, how does the recluse Gotama discipline his disciples? And how is the recluse Gotama's instruction usually presented to his disciples? This is how the Blessed One's disciple disciplines his disciples, Asaji. And this is how the Blessed One instruction is usually presented to his disciples. Monk, material form is impermanent. Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Formations are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. Monk's material form is not self. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. Formations are not self. Consciousness is not self. All formations are impermanent. All things are not self. This is how the Blessed One disciplines his disciples, and this is how the Blessed One's instruction usually is presented to his disciples. If we had heard what the recluse Gotama asserts, we have indeed heard what is disagreeable. Perhaps sometime or other, we might meet Master Gotama and have some conversation with him. Perhaps we might detach him from that evil view. Now at that time, 500 Lekhavis had met together in an assembly hall for some business or other. When Satchaka, the Nigantha's son, went to them and said, come forth, good Lekhavis, come forth, Today there will be some conversation between me and the recluse Gotama. If the recluse Gotama maintains before me what was maintained before me by one of his famous disciples, the monk named Asaji, then just as a strong man might seize a long-haired ramp by the hair and drag him to and drag him fro and drag him round about, so in debate I will drag the recluse Gotama to and drag him fro and drag him round about. Just as a strong brewer's workman might throw a big brewer's sieve into deep water well, and taking it by the corners, drag it to and drag it fro and drag it round about. So in debate I will drag the recluse Gotama to and drag him fro and drag him round about. Just as a strong brewer's mixer might take a strainer by the corners and shake it down and shake it up and thump it about, so in debate I will shake the recluse Gotama down and shake him up and thump him about. And just as a 60-year-old elephant might plunge into deep water pond and enjoy playing the game of hemp washing, so I shall enjoy playing the game of hemp washing with the recluse Gotama. Come forth, good Lekavis, come forth. Today there will be some conversation between me and the recluse Gotama. Thereupon some Lekavis said, who is the recluse Gotama that he could refute Satchika the Nigatha's son's assertions? On the contrary, Satchika the Nigatha's son will refute the recluse Gotama's assertions. And some Lekavis said, who is Satchika the Nigatha's son that he could refute the Blessed One's assertions? On the contrary, the Blessed One will refute Satchika, the Nigatha's son. Then Satchika, the Nigatha's son, went with 500 Lekavis to the hall with the peaked roof in the great wood. Now on that occasion, a number of monks were walking up and down in the open. Then Satchika, the Nigatha's son, went up to them and said and asked, where's the recluse Gotama staying, sirs? We want to see the recluse, Master Gotama. The Blessed One has entered the great wood, Satchika, and is sitting at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. Then Satchika, the Nigatha's son, together with a large following of Lekavis, entered the great wood and went to the Blessed One. He exchanged greetings with the Blessed One. And after this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. Some of the Lekavis paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some pronounced the name and the clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. Some kept silent and sat down at one side. When Satchika, the Nigatha's son, had sat down, he said to the Blessed One, I would like to question Master Gotama on a certain point. If Master Gotama would grant me the favor of an answer to the question, ask what you like, Satchika. How does Master Gotama discipline his disciples? And how is Master Gotama's instruction usually presented to his disciples? This is how I discipline my disciples, Satchika. And this is how my instruction is usually presented to my disciples. Monk's material form is impermanent. Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Formations are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. Monk's material form is not self. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. Formations are not self. Consciousness is not self. All formations are impermanent. All things are not self. That is the way I discipline my disciples, and that is how my instruction is usually presented to my disciples. A simile occurs to me, Master Gotama. Explain how it occurs to you, Satchika. The Blessed One said, just as when seeds and plants, whatever their kind, reach growth, increase, and maturation, all do so in dependence upon the earth, based upon the earth. Just as when strenuous works, whatever their kind, are done, all are done in dependence upon the earth, based upon the earth. So too, Master Gotama, a person has material form as self. Based upon material form, he produces merit or demerit. A person has feeling based upon feeling, he produces merit or demerit. A person has perception as self. Based upon perception, he produces merit or demerit. A person has formations as self and is based upon formations. He produces merit or demerit. A person has consciousness as self and based upon consciousness is produced merit or demerit. Satchika, are you not asserting thus? Material form is self. Feeling is myself. Perception is myself. Formations are myself. Consciousness is myself. I assert thus, Master Gotama, material form is myself. Feeling is myself. Perception is myself. Formations are myself. Consciousness is myself. And so does this great multitude. What does this great multitude have to do with you, Satchika? Please confine yourself to your own assertion alone. Then, Master Gotama, I assert thus. Material form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, formations are myself. And consciousness is myself. In that case, Satchika, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, Satchika? Would a head-anointed king, for example, King Pasanadi of Kosala, or King Ajatasattu of Magadha, exercise the power over his own realm to execute those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, and to banish those who should be banished? Master Gotama, a head anointed noble king, for example, King Pasanadi of Kosala or King Ajatasattu of Magadha, would exercise the power in his own realm to execute those who should be executed, to find those who should be fined, to banish those who should be banished. For even those oligarchic communities and societies, such as the Vijayans and the Malayans, exercise the power over their own realm to execute those who should be executed, to find those who should be fined, and to banish those who should be banished. So all the more should the head anointed noble king, such as King Pasenadi of Kosala or King Ajatasattu, he would exercise it, Master Gotama, and he would be worthy to exercise it. What do you think, Satchika, when you say thus, material form is myself? Do you exercise any such power over that material form as to say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? When this was said, Satchika, the Nigantha's son, was silent. A second time, the Blessed One asked the same question, and a second time, Satchika, the Nigantha's son, was silent. Then the Blessed One said to him, Satchika, answer now. Now is not the time to be silent. If anyone, when asked a reasonable question up to a third time by the Tathagata, still does not answer, his head splits into seven pieces there and then. Now on that occasion, a thunderbolt-wielding spirit, holding an iron thunderbolt that burned, blazed, and glowed, appeared in the air above Satchika, the Nigantha's son, thinking, if Satchika, the Nigantha's son, when he's asked a reasonable question up to a third time by the Blessed One, still does not answer, I will split his head in seven pieces here and now. The Blessed One saw the thunderbolt-wielding spirit, and so did Satchika, the Nigantha's son, but nobody else could see it. Then Satchika, the Nigantha's son, was frightened, alarmed, and terrified, seeking his shelter, asylum, and refuge in the Blessed One himself. He said, ask me, Master Gotama, I will answer. What do you think, Satchika, when you say thus, material form is myself? Do you exercise any such power over that material form as to say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? No, Master Gotama. Pay attention, Satchika, pay attention to how you reply. What you said afterwards does not agree with what you said not before, nor does what you said before agree with what you said afterwards. What do you think, Satchika, when you say thus, feeling is myself? Do you exercise any power over that feeling as to say, let my feeling be thus, let my feeling not be thus? No, Master Gotama. Pay attention, Satchika, pay attention to how you reply. What you said afterwards does not agree with what you said before, nor does what you say before agree with what you said afterwards. What do you think, Satchika, when you say thus, perception is myself? Do you answer, or do you exercise any power over that perception as to say, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus? No, Master Gotama. He's getting pretty well beat up by now. Pay attention, Satchika. Pay attention to how you reply. What you said afterwards does not agree with what you said before. Nor does what you said before agree with what you said afterwards. What do you think, Satchika? When you say thus, formations are myself. Do you exercise any such power over these formations as to say, let my formations be thus, let my formations not be thus? No, Master Gotama. Pay attention, Satchika, pay attention to how you reply. What you said afterwards does not agree with what you said before, nor does what you said before agree with what you said afterwards. What do you think, Satchika? When you say thus, consciousness is myself, do you exercise any such power over that consciousness as to say, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness not be thus? No, Master Gotama. Pay attention, Satchika, pay attention to how you reply. What you said afterwards does not agree with what you said before, nor does what you said before agree with what you said afterwards. What do you think, Satchika? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Master Gotama. What do you think, Satchika? Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Master Gotama. What do you think, Satchika? Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Oh, excuse me, I already did that. Is perception permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Master Gotama. What do you think, Satchika? Are formations permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Master Gotama. What do you think, Satchika? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Master Gotama. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Master Gotama. What do you think, Satchika? When one adheres to suffering, resorts to suffering, holds to suffering, and regards what is suffering thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Could one ever fully understand suffering oneself or abide with suffering utterly destroyed? Interesting question. How could one master Gotama, no master Gotama? What do you think, Satchika? That being so, do you not adhere to suffering, resort to suffering, and hold to suffering, and regard what is suffering thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. How could I not, Master Gotama? Yes, Master Gotama. It is though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, were to come across a sharp axe and enter the wood, and there he would see a large plantain, trunk straight, young, with no fruit bud core. Then he would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the leaf sheaths. But as he went on unrolling the leaf sheath, he would never come to any sapwood, let alone heartwood. So too, Satchika, when you're pressed, questioned, and cross-questioned by me, you're about your own assertion. You turn out to be empty, vacant, and mistaken. But it was you who made this statement before the Visali assembly. I see no recluse or Brahmin, the head of an order, the head of a group, the teacher of a group, even one claiming to be accomplished and fully awakened, who would not shake, shiver, and tremble and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in debate with me, even if I were to engage in a senseless post and debate, it would shake, shiver, and tremble if it were to engage in debate with me. So what shall I say of a human being? Now, there are drops of sweat on your forehead, and they have soaked through your upper robe and fallen to the ground. But there's no sweat on my body now. And the Blessed One uncovered his golden-colored body before the assembly. When this was said, Satchika, the Nigatha son, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. Then Dumukha, the son of the Lekavis, seeing Satchika, the Nigatha's son, in such a condition, said to the Blessed One, "A simile occurs to me, Master Gotama." "Explain how it occurs to you, Dumukha." "Suppose, Venerable Sir, not far from a village or a town, there was a pond with a crab in it. And then a party of boys or girls went down from the town or village to the pond. They went to the water and pulled the crab out of the water and put it on dry land. And whenever the crab extended a leg, they would cut it off, broke it, and smashed it with sticks and stones. So that the crab, with all its legs cut off, broken, and smashed, would be able to get back to the pond as before. So too, all Satchika, the Nigatha son's contortions, writhings, and vacillations have been cut off, broken, and smashed by the Blessed One. And now he cannot get near the Blessed One again for the purpose of debate. When that was said, Satchika, the Nigatha son, told him, "Wait, Dumiko, wait. we are not speaking with you here, we're speaking with Master Gotama. Then he said, let be, Master Gotama, that talk of ours and of other ordinary recluses and Brahmins. It was mere prattle. But in what way is a disciple of Master Gotama one who carries out his instructions, who responds to his advice, who has crossed beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in the teacher's dispensation? Hear, Sachika, any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, near or far, a disciple of mine sees all material forms as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And any kind of feeling whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a disciple of mine sees all feeling as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Hear, Sachka, any kind of perception whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a disciple of mine sees all perception as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Any kind of formations whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a disciple of mine sees all formations as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Any kind of consciousness whatever, past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all disciples of mine sees all consciousness as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. It is in this way that a disciple of mine is one who carries out my instruction, who responds to my advice, who has crossed beyond doubt, becomes free from perplexity, gains intrepidity, and becomes independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. Master Gotama, in what way is a monk an arahat with taints destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge? Hear, Sachika, any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a monk has all material, seeing all material form as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And through not craving and clinging, he is liberated. Any kind of feeling, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. A monk has seen all feeling as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And through not craving and clinging, he is liberated. Any kind of perception, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. A monk has seen all material form as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Any kind of consciousness, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a monk has seen all consciousness as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And through not craving and clinging, he is liberated. It is in this way that a monk is an arahat with taints destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, has laid down the burden, reached his own goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. When a monk's mind is thus liberated, he possesses three unsurpassable qualities: unsurpassable vision, unsurpassable practice, and unsurpassable deliverance. When a monk is thus liberated, he still honors, respects, reveres, and venerates the Tathagata thus. The Blessed One is awakened, and he teaches the Dhamma for the sake of being awake. The Blessed One is tamed, and he tames the Dhamma. He teaches the Dhamma for taming oneself. The Blessed One is at peace, and he teaches the Dhamma for the sake of peace. The Blessed One has crossed over, and he teaches the Dhamma for crossing over. The Blessed One has attained Nibbana, and he teaches the Dhamma for attaining Nibbana. When this was said, Sachaka, the Nigantha's son, replied, Master Gotama, we were bold and impudent in thinking that we could attack Master Gotama and debate. A man might attack a mad elephant and find safety, yet he could not attack Master Gotama and find safety. A man might attack a blazing fire, mass of fire, and find safety, yet he could not attack Master Gotama and find safety. A man could attack a terrible poisonous snake and find safety, yet he could not attack Master Gotama and find safety. We were bold and impudent in thinking that we could attack Master Gotama and debate. Is that what they call eating crow? Let the Blessed One, together with the Sangha of monks, consent to accept tomorrow's meal from me. The Blessed One consented in silence. He just shook his head. then knowing that the Blessed One had consented, Sachaka, the Nigantha son, addressed the Lekavis. Hear me, Lekavis, the recluse Gotama, together with the Sangha of good monks, has been invited by me for tomorrow's meal. You may bring to me whatever you think would be suitable for him. Then when the night was ended, the Lekavis brought 500 ceremonial dishes of milk rice as gift of food. Then Sachaka, the Nigantha son, had good food of various kinds prepared in his own park and had the time announced to the Blessed One. The milk rice, the kind that kind of showing off your wealth, is taking milk and putting the rice in the soil with watering it with milk. And then you take the seeds from that and you do the same thing again the next year. And you take the seeds from that and you do it the same thing the next year. And it really turns out to be quite good rice. I've had it one time. It's amazing. But the milk rice they're talking about was just boiling it in milk. And they did it more in cream. Well, they didn't. It's not really cream. It's water buffalo milk. And water buffalo milk has globs of butter just floating in it. And it doesn't taste the same as cow's milk. But it is quite good, and it is quite filling. And when you boil your rice in that, it really gives it a wonderful taste. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went to the Sangha of monks. He went with the Sangha of monks to the park of Sachaka, the Nigantha son, and sat down on a seat made ready. Then with his own hands, Sachaka, the Nigantha son, served and satisfied the Sangha of monks, headed by the Buddha, with the various kinds of good food. When the Blessed One had eaten and had put his bowl aside, Sachaka, the Nigantha son, took a low seat. Now that's an improvement, because he's tried to sit on the same level as the Buddha when he was questioning him. He sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, may the merit of this great meritorious fruit of this act of giving be for the happiness of the givers. Sachaka, whatever comes from giving to a recipient such as myself, one who is not free from lust, not free from hate, not free from delusion, that will be for the givers. And whatever comes from giving to a recipient such as myself, one who is free from lust, free from hate, and free from delusion, that will be for you. So what he's saying is, when you're practicing your generosity and you are giving to the Sangha, you give it to the Buddha and all of the arahats and all of the Sangha members. That way you get the most amount of merit from that gift. If you give to someone that's still caught up in their lust, hatred, and delusion, you get some merit, but not very much. So a lot of people ask me about why I don't say thank you. If I say thank you, I turn that into a personal gift from you to me. When I say sadhu, I'm the representative of the Buddha and all of the Sangha. So you get much more merit for giving that gift, and that gift belongs to the Sangha. It's a real interesting thing, being a monk and learning that everything that's donated to the Sangha is donated to the Sangha. We can go and get anything we need because we're Sangha members. Every monastery has at least one room full of requisites. I had to build us another small building just to have all of the robes and bowls that's donated to the Sangha so I can give them to people when they come and they ordain and become Sangha members. But if a monk, he tears his robe and it's too hard to sew it up, comes and he said, I need another robe, I'll give it to him. If they have any needs, toothbrush, toothpaste, soap, towels, anything like that, they just come and ask for it and we give it to them because they're brothers and sisters. So it's kind of fun not owning so much stuff. Not having to worry about where my meals are going to be coming from, where medicine is going to be coming from, where any robes. I can walk into any monastery and say, I need a robe, and they'll give it to me. We don't have to buy things. And we take care of each other. If a monk is sick, they come to the monastery, they're going to get well before they leave. We take care of them. And it really gets to be fun. Some monks have a bend towards certain kinds of gifts. When I went to Australia the first time, I went on the longest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. It's June 21st. And that's the shortest day of the year in the Southern Hemisphere, and it's getting to be cold. And I was completely unprepared for it. I had summer robes, and I was walking around with a pair of sandals on, and it got cold. It was down in the 40s, something like that. And I just started thinking, boy, would it ever be nice to have a pair of socks? I was really cold, and I went to the monastery. And one of the first things the monk did was give me a pair of socks. And I thought, oh, this is really good. But then I couldn't turn the socks off. And in a week, I had a dozen pair of socks. And I didn't tell anybody that I wanted them. They just started giving them to me. And to this day, I have a lot of socks. I came to California and I left with 24 pair of socks. What am I going to do with 24 pair of socks? So I give them away. And what you give, you get. So guess what? I have a lot of socks. So any, if you come and you need a pair of socks, let me know. I like this particular sutta very much, not because of the debate, but because it drives home, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Everything, it doesn't matter whether it's physical or mental, everything is impermanent. Everything is impersonal. And it's a hard one to really start to realize, but after you start using the six R's enough, you start seeing that things do arise by themselves and you don't have any control over them. You can't make them be the way you want to be. If you catch a cold, you got a cold. But what you do with that, and not taking it personally. You have a pain arise in your body. It's only a feeling. And it's all right for that feeling to be there. It has to be all right because that's the truth. You can't fight with the truth. When you take the truth personally, and this is me, this is mine, that's when you really start suffering. And you turn a little problem into a huge mountain because you think about it all the time and you try to control it and you try to make it be what you want it to be. When you start seeing the impersonal nature of everything, the big mountain starts turning into little bumps. It's not such a big deal. But when you start getting into your dissatisfaction, your dislike, your want to make it be the way you want it to be, that's when you really start suffering a lot. That's why equanimity is so important to get to. And understanding the process that everything is impersonal, and you start looking at how these things arise, then you start catching these things more quickly and more easily, and you relax into them more, and that leads to true freedom and true happiness. And when you use the six R's and that relaxed step, it starts changing your perspective of everything. And the change in perspective is the impersonal nature of everything. So the things don't, they're not such a big deal. I've told you before, I get very heavily criticized, and I don't care. People can say whatever they want. It doesn't bother me one way or the other. It doesn't make me mad. It doesn't make me want to get even. They can think whatever they want, and that's fine. They can do whatever they want, and that's fine, as long as it doesn't harm other beings. But if I see someone harming someone else, I do have a tendency to try to get in between them so that they don't hurt each other. And I have a secret weapon. It's called radiating loving kindness. And it's amazing. I can be in a restaurant and somebody starts getting in an argument with someone else, and I see that, and I start radiating loving kindness to those people, and before long, they start calming down. And as I continue doing it for a little bit, they actually start talking with each other, apologizing for saying things that they didn't really mean. And you get to see that sort of thing. It's magical. And it works. So the whole idea of remembering to observe how mind's attention moves, you can remember to observe how mind's attention moves in other people. And you can affect the world around you in a positive way when your mindfulness is good. It's okay to send loving kindness to yourself whenever you feel like you need it, like you're getting caught in something. Your mind will start to change. And it takes the emergency out of a lot of problems. The worry, the anxiety, all of these kind of things. When I was in Malaysia, I used to have people, when they were doing a loving kindness retreat, I had them have a jar with a lid on it, and I had them fill it up with water and hold it while they were radiating loving kindness. And any time they felt a little bit of unhappiness coming up, take a sip. The thing with water is it holds memory. It has memory. And when you are purifying your mind with loving kindness, and you're holding the water, that loving kindness goes into the water. And that's what people used to come to me, pregnant women came to me and asked me to hold some water and radiate loving kindness, and then I gave them the bottle. And they would take some water and they would massage the baby in the womb. And if they started feeling a little off, they would drink some water. And it's pretty amazing, because these babies were highly unusual, and it happened a lot of times that the birth was easy. It was not so painful for the women. And when the baby came out, they were smiling. And they would do things that were very peculiar, like sleep all night. That was a favorite of the parents. They thought that was real good. But any time the baby started being upset, they had an upset stomach, take some of that water and just rub it in. And that affected them in a very positive way. There was a baby that I went to go visit. She was about, she must have been 6 weeks old. And her mother had some of that water. And when I went to go see the baby, she was lying down in a little bed. And the baby saw me and went. I thought that was really something. And then when I got ready to leave, the baby did it again. So there's all kinds of fun things that you can look forward to as you remember to stay with your object of meditation, as you remember to smile, as you remember to practice your generosity. And generosity doesn't necessarily mean only giving material things. You practice your generosity in body, speech, and mind. Do things that help other people so they don't have so much suffering. say things to make their minds uplifted. Radiate loving kindness. Radiate one of the Brahma Viharas with your daily activities, as much as you can remember. And watch the miracles happen. It's really kind of fun. So, do we have any questions tonight? The dead silence. Yeah.
The water, loving kindness, I mean, is best to have a jar?
Glass jar, not plastic. Plastics, I don't really trust very much. But glass is good. And quite often I would tell them to use either a green or a blue glass jar. Green is for your heart, and blue is for your mind. So if you want to have a more peaceful thoughts and that sort of thing, then blue is very good. If you want to have more open heart, green works very well. And you can take the water and you use it down a little ways. You can fill it up and shake it like you do with making homeopathic remedies. And it'll energize all of the water again. And sometimes you can really feel the difference, especially if you have a cold. You can feel the difference when you start drinking some. Just put some on your throat if it's sore, or your chest if it's congested in some way. It really does nicely. Yeah?
I got a question. Totally different subject.
Okay.
So, this is kind of a conversation we had on last retreat as well. So, I've noticed and I've heard people talking about spiritual awakenings, and they're talking about kind of two doors opening, and kind of in between the two doors, life is barely manageable. And I've heard this from a number of different people that don't know each other, including Ayushante, who...
I don't know who that is.
He's a Zen monk in the Bay Area. Anyway, so...
An awful lot of people are fascinated with dukkha, and they say everything is dukkha. But that's not the real definition of the First Noble Truth. There is dukkha in life. Not everything is dukkha. In your daily life, you have happiness, you have some painful things. When I was in Burma, I was with this... I went to another monastery when I was at Mahasi Sayadaw for a week to be with this other monk that I thought would be very helpful. And he was very famous. And we would go out on alms round and we would come back with a trailer load full of food. And we got invited to this rich person's house for Adana. And this is like the best food you could ever run across. This is really top of the line, good quality food. And while he was eating, he was going, dukkha, 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 dukkha. Like everything is dukkha. And a person standing behind him said, I want some of that dukkha. But in a sense, he's being right. But in practical everyday life, if you focus on everything being suffering, you're going to cause a lot of unhappiness to yourself. The whole point of Buddhism, it says in the Dhammapada, we're the happy ones because we see the dukkha and we don't take it personally. Yeah, everything is impermanent. Everything that's impermanent is a kind of suffering. But you don't have to indulge in it if you don't take it personally.
First person I actually heard that word from was John Travis. That, you know, door opens pretty wide, and you go through, your life is going to be really different.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of going to be hard to be a hustler.
So, no.
So you doesn't sound like you're buying that.
No. I have way too many students that are householders, mm-hmm. and very few that are in the Sangha. It is harder being a householder because you have things that distract you more. When you're in a Sangha, you have time to see things more clearly. You have time to do more practice and that sort of thing. But I have a student in Russia that he practices between 3 and 5 hours a day. He has a full-time job. He works for one of the ministries pretty high up. He has a family with 3 kids, and he still sits between 3 and 5 hours a day. That's remarkable. So it can be done. But there's some people that are, if they become an anagami, they're satisfied within this lifetime. They don't keep pushing to become an arahat. Deepama was an example of that. She was perfectly happy being a layman. And how many people did she affect in the world?
More than a few.
Yeah. And she didn't push to become an arahat at all. You don't have to be a Sangha member. When you become a Sangha member, it is a different kind of profession. And a lot of people, they'll be monks for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and then they'll disrobe. I don't think that's going to happen for me. Because the robes grabbed onto me when I first ordained and they wouldn't let go. So, I was only going to be a monk for 1 year. Because I went to Thailand and then I went to Burma. And I thought, well, with 1 year, I can become a Sotapanna, get a few jhanas. Everything's fine. But as soon as I put the robes on, I knew I wasn't going to take them off. But I still told everybody, I'm just going to be a monk for 1 year. That was 31 years ago. It is a profession. And when you're really serious about it, you do a lot of studying, you do a lot of practice, you help an awful lot of people get their mind back in balance. And that's what the job is. That's the job description. Yeah.
Going back one topic, can you talk a little bit more about the training to learn to radiate loving kindness?
You're doing it.
I know, that's what I'm asking.
You don't just do it. You're your own teacher. I'm just the guide. You don't need any more answers than what you're getting right now. It's like I was telling you how happy I was when Father Keating, how happy I was when he accepted the idea to put a relaxed step, intentional relaxed step, in with his teaching. And people stopped coming back to prison at Folsom. It was really quite amazing, because when I was working in a prison in Florida, the man that was responsible with this was a Zen teacher, and he was continually having teaching Zen, but having them come out. He gave them a halfway house. They would do something and get thrown back in jail. They kept coming back because of not using the relaxed step, not changing their personality or their habitual tendencies. And a lot of them come back because they're lonely. They want to go back where their friends were. But when you start taking responsibility for your own actions and yourself, you start developing more and different kinds of friends. And it's real fun to have Dhamma friends, because Dhamma friends, they last for a long time, don't they?
What? I sure do.
50 years. Yeah, getting on there. That's a scary number. And it's really fun, because you might not see a Dhamma friend for 25 years, and then you see him, and it's like no time has passed. You talk to him, and you still have the same kind of things that you're interested in, which is Dhamma, and it's a lot more fun. It's real good. I have a lot of monk friends, and every time they come to this country, they find a way to come see me, and we hang out together, and it's just really wonderful. We talk about Dhamma things for sure, but it's really, really great stuff. As far as loving kindness, just do it. Don't try to look for new ways. You know what you're doing, do it that way. Okay?
Could you say something that might be helpful as far as sloth and torpor?
Sloth and torpor? How does it arise? What happens first? I can tell you exactly. I've had enough of it in my life. What happens first?
You're not on your object of meditation anymore?
And you're starting to get a little think about this and think about that very lightly. As soon as you see that, you should be siksari. But you're starting to get lazy. And you kind of let it go. And then you start getting dreamy. And then start slumping a little bit. And then you start bobbing. And then you notice that, and then you sit up real straight, real fast. I'm not going to do that again. Take an interest in how it arises. See the more subtle things. When you're sitting, sit with your back a little bit straighter than is comfortable. Then when you start slumping a little bit, you'll catch it more easily. It won't last as long. One of the things I noticed when I was in Burma doing a 2-year retreat, at the same time every day until I started catching it and started doing other things so I wouldn't get sloth and torpor coming up. But at the same time every day, I would have about 5 minutes of sloth and torpor. And I could set my watch by it. I mean, it was pretty amazing. When I started noticing that, right before I would get the sloth and torpor, that's when I would get up and start walking. And in Burma, everybody sits together. The laymen and the monks all sit in this same hall. And you're supposed to sit until 10 o'clock. Well, about 9 o'clock, everybody starts getting a little sleepy. And I was starting to notice that it was affecting me too. It was like group energy just got real, real slow, and everybody was sleepy, and they just started getting up and leaving. So what I did instead was I got up and walked while they were like that, and that kept my energy going. They would leave by 9:45, and then I could sit with good energy, and I would sit until 1 o'clock in the morning, 1:30, something like that. And then I would, and if my sitting was good, I would sit longer. So being aware of the group energy is something that's, If everybody is getting tired at the same time, that's when I do the opposite. I get up and start getting my energy built up again. So, you had a question?
Oh, my question was answered in the course of your answer. I wanted to know if it was 10 o'clock at night or in the day.
At night. Burma was really interesting. When you come here, everybody's quiet. Don't disturb anybody else. Over there, one of their cultural habits is spitting. And they not only spit, they hawk. They belch while you're sitting in meditation. They pass gas while they're sitting in meditation. They're moving around all the time. It is not quiet in a meditation hall in Asia. It just isn't. And that's something that I had to get used to because, well, it's supposed to be quiet. What are you guys doing? And at the center I was at, they needed more water because they were starting to get fairly big at times. They had, 500 or 600 people that they ordained for the new year period. So they had to have a lot of water for washing and cleaning and drinking and all of that. So they decided to drill a well right outside the meditation hall. And there's no doors on the meditation hall, it's just screens. So they would start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they had a motor that didn't have a muffler on it, and it was and it went like that till 6 o'clock at night. And then for about a half an hour, it was quiet. And then outside the meditation, the wall for the meditation hall, on the sidewalk, tea tables started coming with loudspeakers. And they started playing their Burmese music loudly, and that happened until 10 o'clock at night. And then it got quiet again for about 40, 45 minutes. And then the neighbors started up their generators. And they would keep the generators going till about, sometimes all night, sometimes they would just keep them going till 1 or 1:30 in the morning. So there was constant noise. And it didn't matter how much we didn't like it, it was there. So you had to accept the fact that it was there. And I had good meditation there. Even though there was all of this racket that was going. And of course there's mosquitoes. And they come in the morning, they come in the evening. So, rather than get mad at them and go someplace else, I have no problem with mosquitoes. We had to be inventive.
How long do you think it took for you to adapt so that you could handle that?
When I first got there, there was another thing that happened. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, we were not very far from an army base, and they would have people out running in front of the monastery at about 4:15 with a hep, 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 making noise like that. So I had to be able to accept all of that. It took about, the hawking was the hardest to get used to. Because it wasn't on any timetable. It had happened at all different times. And then Sayadaw, I complained to him about it, and he made it a rule that they couldn't hawk in the monastery. They had to go outside. And if they were going to spit, he had a 5-gallon bucket with some sawdust in it, so there wasn't any smells and that sort of thing coming from it. But it was about 6 weeks or 2 months before I finally dropped my resistance, because it was me all the way that was causing this problem. It was real easy to blame the culture that I was in, but it wasn't the culture's fault. It was entirely mine. So I started accepting it, and then I didn't really hear it too much. But when they stopped drilling for the water, and they did this for the whole 3 months, there was always a feeling of relief. for a little while. And it was kind of fun with the tea tables, because they'd have a limited number of video or cassette players, so you could hear the same song going down the street, different. And they took some of the Beatles songs and then changed it into Burmese language, but you know the tune, and all of a sudden it's playing in your mind. It took a while to get used to that and not pay attention to it.
There was a question I had about the about your main reading for tonight, which I think I didn't understand, and would be grateful if you could explain something in it.
What?
It sounded as if a demon showed up who then scared the pants off the guy who was making claims. But how come the demon is actually sort of, is the demon making the case? I didn't hear.
No, the Buddha made the case.
Argument together.
The Buddha made the case. He said, that's what happens if you keep silent when I ask a question that's reasonable.
Oh, I see.
When I ask it for the third time, if you don't do this, your head's going to split in seven pieces.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So in other words, it was a demand that something has to be said,
right,
from which there is a reasonable answer to the Buddha in order for the head splitting not to happen.
Right.
Okay.
So this chap went back to the well again, and later in the Dharma, and started arguing with the Buddha again.
Oh yeah, he was quite offensive.
Persistent.
Yeah. Yeah, he was very offensive.
Is there not that?
And he was one of these kind of people that he was thinking while the Buddha was talking, so he didn't really hear him.
Uh-huh.
And he caused himself a lot of problems.
He must have had his legs and arms crossed.
Yeah. That must have been it. But he was not very. He went around to all the other supposed teachers of the time and caused them problems. And he took joy in that. And he tried to do that to the Buddha, I think it was four or five times. But he just wasn't paying attention to what the answers was, so he didn't really learn anything. And that happened with another monk, and the Buddha went, and he was out for alms round, and he decided it was too early. So he went to this park where there was a lot of ascetics who were talking very loudly and laughing and doing all kinds of not very nice things, licking themselves and that sort of thing. And the head of that saw the Buddha coming in the future, down the road a ways, and he told all of the monks, his disciples, be quiet. The Buddha and all of the Buddhist monks, they prefer quiet. So, and maybe if we're lucky, he'll come and he'll talk with us. But he came, the Buddha came to talk with this head monk. And everything, the Dhamma lesson that he gave, the other monks didn't get it at all because they weren't being attentive. And they couldn't understand what the Buddha was talking about, but this head monk did, and became a Buddhist, actually. So, during the time of the Buddha, there was a lot of people that were very attentive, and they gained mightily because he was coming to see them and that sort of thing. And there were a lot of them that were caught in their own dogma, there were a lot of them that just, they weren't attentive enough or interested enough to figure out what the Buddha was saying. But he still affected most of India and other countries around. So Mahasi Sayadaw said that during the time of the Buddha, he said he affected about 60 million people. That's pretty strong teaching.
So I wonder what affected means.
They became Buddhist. They started practicing the way he was teaching.
And so a lot of us had to be householders.
Most. Here's a sutta that I think you'll like. I don't remember if it's 80 or 81. I might have the number wrong. Find it right now, but he talks about people were asking him how many Sakadagamis are there, how many Anagamis are there, and he would say there's more than 100, more than 500, more than 1,000. He would answer like that, and then they would say, and a white-clothed layman, and how many are Sakadagamis? And he did the same number thing up to Anagami.
Because I had heard that there are more people, householders, that attain a spiritual awakening during the Buddha's times than monks. And I was wondering if that was...
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. There wasn't that many monks. And a lot of the monks were into memorizing the suttas, and they didn't do the practice. At the Third Buddhist Council is where they decided that what is the best way to keep the Buddha's teaching alive? Was it through practice or was it through scholarship? And they decided it was scholarship. Out of 100 monks, there might be 3 to 5 that actually do the practice. When I was in Burma, I went to Mandalay, which is the scholarship capital of Burma. And I stayed in a monastery that had 2,000 monks in it, and it was a teaching monastery. They would learn some of meditation, but mostly it was like school.
Sounds like hell.
Well, they like it. What can you do? I had the opportunity to meet some very remarkable people, like this one monk. He was, when I met him, I think he was 98 years old, something like that, 97. When he was 23, he took a test. And his mind was such that he heard something one time and he had it memorized. And he took this test nationwide. He was number one in the country that year. And because of his scholarship, they gave him a monastery that had 500 monks in it. And that was his job, to keep the tradition alive and get them to practice reciting. And they recite at the top of their lungs. It's a real, real noisy place. It's not a place to do quiet meditation. But he was truly remarkable.
In Burma, is it still all in Pali?
It's Burmese Pali, which is kind of a mixture of both. And if you try to speak it to Sri Lankans, they won't understand it because the pronunciation is so poor, according to the... And it's that way in Sri Lanka, too. Their regular language has a lot of Pali in it. But their pronunciation is better than any of the other countries around. So they started calling that the international Buddhism, or international Pali language. And this is because of the scholarship and not doing the actual practice. This is where some scholarship goes off course and they start taking commentaries and things like that. And they start teaching other people the commentaries and the practice that way. And that happens. Buddhism has its ups and downs. And right now, I was told that this is the last time we're going to have an upswing in practice. And after this, then things are going to start going and decaying even more and more.
Over what time scale?
Another 2,000 years. But the Buddhism is going to get so poor that people won't remember any of the actual teaching of the Buddha, and monks won't even be able to remember one rule that monks have to follow. And it's happened before. In Sri Lanka, they had a drought. All the monks left and went to India. There was only a Samanera that stayed. And he's the one that reintroduced Buddhism and started pulling some of the Buddhist scholars back. It was a drought that lasted something like 12 years or something. It was really a difficult time at that time. And there was, at another time, there was a drought, and there was 10 monks that they couldn't get enough to eat, so they took a rock and put it on their stomach so that they wouldn't feel so hungry, and they just started chanting the suttas, and they got through that too eventually. Then it starts growing again.
And in your on the board of the World Association of Buddhist Teachers, aren't you all
The World Buddhist Council.
World Buddhist Council.
Yeah.
Does the World Buddhist Council have concerns about the effects of global warming on spirituality?
No. If nature's going to do it, it's going to do it. I mean, why worry? Really?
You know, I brought a picture of, I don't know if I have it here. I have it here. This is really remarkable. But here's a picture of Bhante at the World Buddhist Summit. And should I just,
yeah.
Would you like to hold it up in front of you?
Well,
maybe
I can.
Maybe I can see you.
Okay, where am I?
I gotta put my butt.
Lower, kind of the
right hand side, yeah.
About 10 over?
No, 3 over.
3 over.
There I am, right there. This is 10,000 people.
I'll leave that out up here for y'all to look at.
I would have thought that the Buddhists would have a great deal of compassion for what may happen to the people of the world rather than just say,
we do, but we don't get involved in that sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
It's more on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
And what good does worry do?
It makes you take necessary precautions against disaster.
Does it? It doesn't matter whether it happens or not. I mean, for a truly spiritual viewpoint, I've had a lot of people ask me about this sort of thing, and it's like, well, if we have the world blowing up, if there are going to be bombs tearing the land apart, I'm going to die. But I'm going to be reborn someplace else, so what? I don't worry about it. I don't even consider it. I don't think about it.
So the rebirth can be off planet in a different
Oh,
planet.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there are times when disasters happen in the world and all human beings are gone from it for a period of time. They get reborn in another solar system. So, that's what samsara is all about.
Because it's a much bigger perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing with the Christian idea in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Well, Keshri Dhammananda was with a Christian that was talking like that, and he said, I have a question for you. What did God do before he created heaven and earth? And the guy looked at him for a minute and he said, he created hell for people like you that ask those kind of questions. Oh, yeah.
So it's, you know, it's Western view is just...
It's very limited.
I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe they... That's
and that's okay. It doesn't really matter. What matters is seeing how mind works. Seeing how to let go of craving. That purifies your mind, that makes you more happy. And again, it doesn't matter. I've had Muslim students that were successful. And they ask if they can go back to praying five times a day. Fine. You can do whatever you want. It's your choice. We're not in competition with anyone. And that's really an important thing to understand. Some things can sound off to you, but so what? It's okay, as long as you're watching how your mind works. That's the important aspect of this. The thing that drew me to Buddhism was the self-responsibility. I didn't have to depend on anything out there to give my troubles to take care of. I had to do it inside. And that's really important. And if you feel like you need to do that with some outside source, okay, so can you still relax that tension and tightness in your head? If you're comfortable with praying to Allah or Jesus or Muhammad or any of the gurus that come along, that's fine. You can do that. As long as you have a relaxed step in there that lets go of the craving. And it's not religious. That's the one of my pet peeves, is they put Buddhism in with religion, and it's not. But they'd sit down and they have all these rites and rituals and they pray to a statue. Well, it's not like that. The chanting that they do, they're reciting different suttas, and doing that can help sometimes to calm your mind down. So fine, do that, but understand what you're saying when you do a sutta. Don't just use words blindly. Everything about Buddhism is about understanding. Understand how mind works. Understand what you're doing with yourself. What causes suffering. How to let go of the suffering. It's a lot of responsibility for yourself that I kind of cherish, really. I like it a lot. So, any other question? Yeah?
So, the hindrances are there because you've broken precepts in the past.
Right.
Is that limited to the five precepts, or does that also include others?
I don't call the hindrances all that often. I call them distractions. Any kind of distraction, anything that pulls away you away from your object of meditation is a hindrance. But when you call it a distraction, you don't have to limit it to these five. It's just a distraction. And if you want to get more particular with it and say, well, this is restlessness, or this is the dislike, or whatever it happens to be, you can do that. But if you just call it a distraction, you know what you need to do with it, and that means 6R it, let it be, relax into it.
But I mean, are we talking about, are they just from breaking the five precepts, or are there other precepts, like listening to music or something?
No, the eight precepts are just for meditation. Okay. And every new moon and full moon is when the layman in Burma and Thailand, Cambodia, that's when they put on their white clothes, they go to the monastery, they take 8 precepts just for that day, and then the next day they go back to 5 precepts. Listening to music in itself is not bad, but it does excite the mind. If you want to spend a day of meditation, you don't want to be listening to music or spending time dolling yourself up or using different fragrances and that sort of thing. The five basic precepts are the ones that you want to keep as closely as you can without breaking them. And when you do that, you'll start to see that there's a lot more possibilities and things start opening up for you. Things become easier. The breaking the precepts, especially speech, is amazing. When you start keeping that, it's really amazing. Now, I had a student, I won't tell you who it was, but I had them for many years, and they would keep the 8 precepts on retreat. When they got off retreat, they cursed like a sailor. And they were, every other idea was the F word or some kind of curse word. And I kept telling them over and over again, stop doing that. I don't want to hear it, and you're hurting yourself. He came for retreat after retreat after retreat. The first 7 days of the retreat was a lot of hindrances. And then he'd finally settled down. Just before he got home, he went home, his mind calmed down and he started actually to make progress with the meditation. But he kept on shooting himself in the foot because, oh, I can't wait till I get home and can be the way I want to be. And that's a problem. You have to look at Buddhism as a challenge to change. Not be the same way you've always been. Find a new way that has more happiness and uplifting of not only yourself, but other people. I don't know of anybody that likes to hear the cursing that's happening in movies and television and even the radio. I mean, I was completely shocked when I came back from Asia and all this cursing, you can't get away from it. And people think it's okay, and it's not. They hurt themselves. They cause themselves a lot of problem. When you use curse words, what's happening in your mind?
Tension,
tightness? Dislike,
mm-hmm.
anger. Are any of those wholesome?
Nope.
And it interferes with your communication with other people because they're hearing the curse words and not hearing what you're actually trying to talk about. And that's a problem. And it happened for my student for many years like that before I finally got through, I don't want to hear this anymore. Stop doing it. Then when they stopped, they started progressing fairly quickly. So it's important to keep your precepts. And stay in harmony with everyone else around you. Because when you break a precept, you get out of harmony. Okay? Okay, let's share some air then. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.